Side 1, cassette number 6, A Glamour, A World Problem, continuing on page 229.
As I earlier pointed out, the inexperienced group of workers will begin by dealing with one of the glamours which hinder aspirants and will pass on from these to handle the more powerful and more widely dispersed glamours which trouble humanity as a whole. This preface to the work is frequently called the act of naming, because both the group members and also the glamour are named. The next stage is similar to the preparatory stages in the formula for the dissipation of glamour for the individual. You have therefore the following. The preparatory stages. 1. The act of naming. 2. The protective formula. The protective formula is very simple. The members of the group will say in unison, quote, "As a soul, I work in light, and darkness cannot touch me. I take my stand within the light. I work, and from that point, I never move." Close quote. As they say this, each person in the group makes the sign of the cross by touching the center of the forehead, the center of the chest, and each of the two eyes, thus forming the long-limbed cross of the Christ, or of divine humanity. The cross is not, as you well know, simply a Christian symbol. It is the great symbol of light and of consciousness, and signifies the vertical light and the horizontal light, the power of attraction and the power of radiation, soul life, and service. The cross, as now made in the Catholic churches, touching the forehead, the heart, and the two shoulders, is the sign of matter. It signifies, in reality, the third aspect. The cross which the group will make is the cross of Christ and of the Christ consciousness. Gradually, the cross of Christ, the cross of the risen Christ, will supersede the cross of matter and of the mother aspect. Its likeness to the swastika is obvious and will be one of the reasons for its disappearance. 3. The preparatory stages. A. Focusing the dual personality light of matter and of mind. B. Meditation on soul contact and the recognition of soul light. C. The blending and fusion of the two lesser lights and of soul light. This is carried forward as a group, each member making his contribution and consciously attempting to visualize the process of blending the triple light, which each contributes, into one sphere of light. 4. Then the group says in unison at a signal from the leader, quote, "The light is one, and in that light shall we see light. This is the light that turns the darkness into day." Close quote. Om, om, om. The processes of individual and group alignment and integration can now be regarded as completed, and when it is really correctly accomplished, each meeting thereafter should see a more rapid integration and fusion, and a greater brilliance of the sphere of light thus created. The sounding of Om indicates both the fusion and the sphere of action, because Om is first of all sounded forth by the group soul, the realized unity of the souls of all the group members, and then as the soul upon the mental plane, and finally as the soul ready to function as light-bearer and distributor of light upon the astral plane. These are all symbolic ways of registering the inner reality and are an attempt to externalize force, for that is what all symbols and symbolic ways of acting are capable of doing. They thus serve to keep the workers at a point of tension. This is an important recognition and should keep the workers from attributing undue power to the form aspect of the simple ritual and aid them in focusing their attention in the world of meaning and of subjective spiritual activity. These three stages are called 1. The act of naming, 2. The act of protection, 3. The act of focusing the light. It will be apparent to you that much depends upon the ability of the group members to visualize clearly as well as to think clearly. Practice naturally tends to perfect both processes. At the close of these three stages, the group members are united as souls, insulated against the attractive power of the glamour, and united as souls with mind and brain held steady and positive in the light. Their blended light is looked upon by them as a great searchlight whose beams are to be directed through an act of the will downward from the mental plane onto the glamour existing on the astral plane and which has been brought into relation with the group by the very act of naming it. I am going into detail on this matter because the work is a new venture and I am anxious for you to start it with a clear understanding as to how the task is to be carried out. At the close of this instruction, you will find the two long and two short formulas so that they can be seen and grasped apart from their explanatory context. This initial work should take 15 minutes at first, and later not more than 5, excluding the 10 minutes of silent preparation which precedes the formal work. For the group members will get used to working together and will eventually attain the objectives of the preparatory work with great rapidity. The technique or formula. 5. Then together and in vocal unison, the group says, quote, "Radiance we are and power. We stand forever with our hands stretched out, linking the heavens and the earth, the inner world of meaning and the subtle world of glamour. We reach into the light and bring it down to meet the need. We reach into the silent place and bring from thence the gift of understanding. Thus, with the light we work and turn the darkness into day." Close quote. As they say this, the group visualizes the turning of the great searchlight, which they have jointly created by their unified light, onto the glamour to be dissipated, holding the light steady and realizing mentally the work of dissipation it is intended to do. This is called the act of direction. 6. Then follows a pause for a few minutes in which the group attempts to throw behind the searchlight their united, directed, and dynamic will or intent. This carries along the projected beam of light the destructive quality of the spiritual will, destructive to all that hinders the manifestation of divinity. This is done by attaining a united point of tension and the dedication of the individual and group will to the will of God. This is called the act of will and is carried on by each member of the group silently and with a deep realization that all are thus accepted and that it is the group will which is being silently focused. Then together they say, quote, "With power upon its beam, the light is focused on the goal." Close quote. 7. Then comes the act of projection and the saying of the words of power, which, again naming the particular glamour which is the subject of attention and thus bringing it consciously into relation with the focused light, begins the task of dissipation. Quote, "The power of our united light prevents the appearance of the glamour of," naming it. "The power of our united light negates the quality of the glamour from affecting men. The power of our united light destroys the life behind the glamour." Close quote. These words are very nearly the same as those in the individual formula and gain strength from the experience of the aspirant and from his familiarity with their use. This constitutes an act of affirmation, which is the second part of the act of projection. 8. Then comes an important aspect of the work in which the group members visualize the gradual dissipation and dispersal of the glamour by the penetration of the light into its darkness. They endeavor to see it disintegrating and the reality emerging, doing this by an effort of the creative imagination. Each will do this in his own way and according to his understanding and capacity. This is the act of penetration. 9. Now follows 5 minutes of silence and intensity of purpose while the group waits for the work instituted to go forward. Then follows the group withdrawal of its consciousness from the astral plane and the world of glamour. The group members refocus their attention first of all on the mental plane and then on the soul, relinquishing all thought of the glamour, knowing that the work has been successfully carried forward. They reorganize themselves as a group in relation to the kingdom of souls and to each other. Occultly speaking, the searchlight of the soul is shut off. This is the act of withdrawal. 10. The Om is then sounded in group formation, and then, in order to emphasize that the group work is ended, each member of the group sounds the Om alone, saying, quote, "So let it be, and help me in my own life to end all glamour and untruth." Close quote. It will take aspirants some time to gain facility in this work, but it is surely obvious that in learning what is an entirely new technique of service, each step must be mastered and practiced for quite a long time. Every new branch of learning takes some time to become familiar, and this one is no exception. But the effort is well worthwhile, both from the individual angle and as an act of service to humanity. that all the groups may learn to function in the light, and that glamour may disappear from all your lives so that you may walk freely in that light and use that light for others, is the wish of my heart for you. Formula for the dissipation of glamour for the individual. Preparatory stages. 1. Recognition of the glamour to be dissipated. This involves A. A willingness to cooperate with the soul. B. Understanding the nature of the particular glamour. 2. The three stages of focusing. A. Focusing the dual light of matter and mind in the mental body. B. Focusing through meditation this dual light and the light of the soul. C. Focusing these three lights and so creating the searchlight for the dissipation of glamour. 3. Preparedness through alignment and integration. This is the production of a field of magnetic thought substance. 4. The turning of the attention and of the searchlight of the mind onto the astral plane. The formula. 5. The soul breathes out the Om into the waiting personality, and the light and power thus generated are retained for use. 6. An intense light is slowly and consciously generated. 7. The spiritual will is invoked whilst the mind is held steady in the light. 8. The glamour to be dissipated and the searchlight of the mind are brought into relationship. 9. The searchlight is then turned on by an act of the will, and a strong beam of light is projected into the glamour. 10. The glamour is named, and the aspirant says with tension, inaudibly, quote, "The power of the light prevents the appearance of the glamour," naming it. "The power of the light negates the quality of the glamour from affecting me. The power of the light destroys the life behind the glamour," close quote. 11. The Om is sounded by the aspirant, producing an act of penetration. This produces impact, penetration, and dissipation. 12. The aspirant, having done his work, withdraws himself consciously onto the mental plane, and the beam of light fades out. Brief form of the individual formula. 1. The four preparatory stages. A. Recognition of the glamour to be dissipated. B. Focusing the dual light of the personality. C. Meditation and recognition of soul light. D. Unification of the three lights. 2. The process of alignment and of recognized integration. 3. The turning of the searchlight of the mind to the astral plane. The formula. 4. Soul activity and the retention of the triple light. 5. The generating and visualizing of the searchlight. 6. The evocation of the will behind the searchlight of the mind. 7. The searchlight of the mind is turned upon the glamour, directed by thought. 8. The naming of the glamour and the triple affirmation. 9. The act of penetration. 10. The process of withdrawing. Formula for the dissipation of world glamour. Technique for a group. The preparatory stages. 1. The naming of the group members, followed by 10 minutes silence. 2. The protective formula. The group members say in unison, quote, "As a soul, I work in light, and darkness cannot touch me. I take my stand within the light. I work, and from that point, I never move," close quote. As these words are uttered, each group member makes the sign of the cross of divinity. 3. The three preparatory stages. A. Focusing the dual light of matter and mind. B. Meditation on soul contact and recognition of soul light. C. The fusion of the two lesser lights with soul light. 4. On a signal from the leader, the group says together, quote, "The light is one, and in that light shall we see light. This is the light that turns the darkness into day," close quote. Om, Om, Om. The formula. 5. Then together the group says, quote, "Radiance are we and power. We stand forever with our hands stretched out, linking the heavens and the earth, the inner world of meaning and the subtle world of glamour. We reach into the light and bring it down to meet the need. We reach into the silent place and bring from thence the gift of understanding. Thus with the light we work and turn the darkness into day." Close quote. As these words are said, the group members visualize the great searchlight they have created, turning its light upon the astral plane. 6. A pause follows, and then comes the invocation of the spiritual will. When this has been done, the group says, quote, "With power upon its beam, the light is focused on the goal." Close quote. 7. The glamour to be dissipated is named, and the light is thrown upon it. The words of power are uttered. Quote, "The power of our united light prevents the appearance of the glamour of," naming it. "The power of our united light negates the quality of the glamour from affecting man. The power of our united light destroys the life behind the glamour." Close quote. 8. Visualization of the light penetrating into the glamour and producing its weakening and dissipation. 9. 5 minutes of silence and intensity of purpose whilst the work is seen proceeding. Then the group members refocus themselves upon the mental plane, turning their attention away from the astral plane. The searchlight of the soul is shut off. 10. The sounding of the Om individually and aloud by each member. Brief form of the group formula. 1. The act of naming. 2. The act of protection. 3. The act of focusing the lights. 4. The act of direction. 5. The act of invoking the will. 6. The act of projection and affirmation. 7. The act of penetration. 8. The act of withdrawal. Our consideration of glamour is nearing its close. We have carried a consecutive theme steadily and have traced the threefold aspect of the world illusion as it appears upon the mental plane and there conditions the intelligentsia of the world, as it appears upon the astral plane where it constitutes the glamour to which the masses of men succumb. We shall now consider the world of Maya in which we, physically, live and move and have our being. I wonder if those who read my words appreciate the importance of this entire subject, or if they are aware of the wide field of service which it opens up, making practical, as it does, all human living, and indicating likewise the steps whereby reality can be known and all veiling forms disappear. Behind these words of illusion, glamour, and Maya lies truth. This truth is the clear consciousness of being, of existence, and of essential initial reality. That is the reason that Christ stood mute before Pilate, who symbolized the human intellect. He knew that no reply could convey meaning to that veiled, inhibited mind. Illusion is the mode whereby limited understanding and material knowledge interpret truth, veiling and hiding it behind a cloud of thought forms. Those thought forms become then more real than the truth they veil, and consequently control man's approach to reality. Through illusion, he becomes aware of the apparatus of thought, of its activity expressed in thought-form building, and of that which he succeeds in constructing and which he views as the creation of his intellect. He has, however, created a barrier between himself and that which is, and until he has exhausted the resources of his intellect or has deliberately refused to utilize it, his divine intuition cannot function. It is the intuition which reveals true being and which induces a state of spiritual perception. Then the technique of the presence becomes an established habit. Glamour, in its turn, veils and hides the truth behind the fogs and mists of feeling and emotional reaction. It is of unique and terrible potency, owing to the strength of human nature to identify itself with the astral nature and to the vital nature of conscious and sentience response itself. As you know and have been taught, glamour can only be dissipated by the inflow of clear, directed light. This is true of the life of the individual or of humanity as a whole. Illumination reveals, first of all, the existence of glamour. It provides the distressing contrasts with which all true aspirants wrestle, and then gradually it floods the life to such an extent that eventually glamour completely vanishes. Men see things then as they are, a facade hiding the good, the beautiful, and true. The opposites are then resolved, and consciousness is superseded by a condition of realization, a realization of being for which we have no adequate term. The technique of light becomes a permanent condition. 3, the technique of indifference. We come now to a brief study of the third aspect of illusion, to which we give the name Maya, and to the technique which can overcome it. We will deal next with the technique of indifference, which is concerned with the distribution of soul force upon the physical plane via the etheric plane, leading to inspiration. This is related to the science of the breath. What then is Maya? This, my brother, is not easy to define because it is related to the form-building activity of the planetary logos himself. However, a consideration of the analogy existing between the microcosm and the macrocosm may help somewhat. The soul creates a threefold expression in the three worlds of human living. This is an occult truism. The outer form, the dual physical body, dense and vital or etheric, is produced, created, motivated, energized, and conditioned by certain energies and forces emanating from those levels whereon the soul has, rightly or wrongly, engineered a reaction of identification. Note this phrase, my brother. These make the man what he is. They give him his temperament, profession, and quality upon the physical plane. They make him negative or positive to various types of impacting energy. They give him his character and make him what he appears to be to others. They produce his coloring, his capacities, and his personality. With all of these, the average man identifies himself. He believes himself to be the form, the medium through which he attempts to express his desires and his ideas. This complete identification with the transient creation and with the outer appearance is Maya. It must be remembered that individual Maya is a fractional part of the world of energies and forces which constitute the life expression of the planetary logos, which condition our outer planetary life and make our planet what it appears to be to the other planets. The difference between man, the microcosm, and the planetary logos, the lord of the world, the macrocosm, lies in the fact that the lord of the world is not identified with the Maya which he has created, and which has its purpose in eventually bringing about the release of the prisoners of the planet. To that Maya, he is supremely indifferent, and it is this divine indifference which has led to the great theological illusion of an anthropomorphic deity, and to the belief, in the East, that our planet is but the background or the plaything of the gods. It is this cosmic indifference which has led to the human glamour concerning the inscrutable will of God, and to the affirmation that God is far away and not immanent in every creature and in every atom of which creatures are made. These are some aspects of the glamours and illusions which must be dispelled and dissipated, and in the process, discovery will be made that the form is only Maya and can be disregarded, that forces can be organized and directed by energy, and that the world of thought, the field of sentient consciousness, and the playground of the energies are something apart from the thinker, from the one who feels, and from the actor and player of the many parts which the soul undertakes to play. The disciple learns eventually to know himself to be, above everything else, whilst in incarnation, the director of forces. These he directs from the altitude of the divine observer and through the attainment of detachment. These are things which I have oft told you before. These truths are for you only the platitudes of occultism, and yet if you could but grasp the full significance of detachment and stand serene as the observing director, there would be no more waste motion, no more mistaken moves, and no more false interpretations, no wandering down the bypaths of daily living, no seeing others through distorted and prejudiced vision, and, above all, no more misuse of force. Again and again down the ages, the masters have told their disciples, as I have told you, that the occultist works in the world of forces. All human beings live and move and express themselves in and through that same world of ever-moving, ever-impacting, outgoing and incoming energies. The occultist, however, works there. He becomes a conscious directing agent. He creates upon the physical plane that which he desires, and that which he desires is the pattern of things and the design laid down upon the trestle board of the spiritual consciousness by the great divine architect. Yet he identifies himself not with the pattern or with the force which he employs. he moves in the world of Maya free from all illusion, unhindered by glamour and uncontrolled by the Mayavic forces. He is rapidly arriving, as far as his own little world is concerned, at the same divine indifference which characterizes Sanat Kumara, the Lord of the World. Therefore, increasingly, he becomes aware of the plan as it exists in the universal mind and the purpose which motivates the will of God. It is this divine indifference which is responsible for the fact that in attempting to describe pure being, or God, and in the effort to arrive at some understanding of the nature of divinity, the formula of negation has been evolved. God is not this, God is not that. God is no thing. God is neither time nor space. God is not feeling or thought. God is not form or substance. God simply is. God is, apart from all expression and manifestation, as the manipulator of energy, the creator of the tangible and the intangible worlds, the pervader of life, or the indweller in all forms. God is the one who can withdraw, and in withdrawing, dispel, dissipate, and devitalize all that has been created, using those words in their fullest significance. It would be obvious to you, therefore, that in these three activities of that reality which is not identified with appearance, the will of God, the destroyer aspect of deity, is beneficently present. The act of abstraction produces the dispelling of the illusory world of thought. The withdrawal of the divine attention dissipates the sentient universe and brings glamour to an end. The cessation of divine direction brings death to the physical world. All these activities are evidences of the will, or of the first aspect, the will to good, which can and will function in perfection only when goodwill is finally and fully developed on earth through the agency of humanity. The will and the breath, my brother, are occultly synonymous terms. In this statement you have the clue to the ending of Maya. The above remarks are preliminary to our study of the technique of indifference. It is necessary to point out analogies and to link together the various aspects of related teaching if true perception is to be developed. Let us divide our consideration of this subject as follows. 1. Activity upon the etheric plane, i.e. the world of forces. A. Their distribution. B. Their manipulation. 2. The science of the breath. A. The relation of the will and the breath. B. Inspiration. 3. The technique of indifference. A. Through concentration. B. Through detachment. We enter now the field of practical occultism. This is not the field of aspiration or the sphere of a planned moving forward towards that which is higher and desirable. It is, in some ways, a reverse activity. From the point reached upon the ladder of evolution, the disciple stands in spiritual being, as far as in him lies, and consciously, deliberately works with the energies in the three worlds. He directs them into the etheric body from whatever level he chooses to work, mental, emotional, or from the vital plane itself. He does this in conformity with some visioned idea, some cherished ideal, some sensed divine pattern, some spiritual hope, some consecrated ambition, or some dedicated desire. The etheric body of the individual is, as you know, a part of the etheric body of humanity, and this, in its turn, is an aspect of the etheric body of the planet, which is likewise an intrinsic part of the etheric body of the solar system. Incidentally, in this far-reaching factual relationship, you have the basis of all astrological influences. Man moves, therefore, in a whirlpool of forces of all types and qualities. He is composed of energies in every part of his manifested and unmanifested expression. He is, therefore, related to all other energies. His task is one of supreme difficulty and needs the great length of the evolutionary cycle. With the mass of world energies and systemic forces, we cannot here deal, but we will confine ourselves to the consideration of the individual problem, advising the student to endeavor to extend his understanding of the microcosmic situation to the macrocosmic. A. Force distribution and manipulation upon the etheric plane. We will now assume that the aspirant is aware of the need for him to establish a new and higher rhythm in his physical plane life, to organize his time in obedience to the injunction of his higher self, and to produce, consciously and scientifically, those effects which, in his highest moments, are presented to him as desirable. He has now a certain amount of knowledge as to the equipment available for his task, and has mastered some facts anent the etheric vehicle. The pairs of opposites are clearly seen by him, even if he is as yet influenced by one or other of them. He is aware of a basic disagreement between his vision of goodness and his expression of that goodness. He has learned that he is a triple reflection of a higher trinity, and that this trinity is, for him, the reality. He understands that mind, emotions, and physical being are intended eventually to manifest that reality. In the last analysis, he knows that if that intermediate aspect of himself, the etheric body, can be controlled and rightly directed, then vision and expression will and must finally coincide. He is also aware that the dense physical body, the outer tangible appearance, is only an automaton, obedient to whatever forces and energies are the controlling factors in the subjective, conditioning the man. Is that physical body to be controlled by emotional force, pouring through the sacral center and producing desire for the satisfaction of the physical appetites, or through the solar plexus, leading to emotional satisfaction of some kind? Is it to be responsive to the mind and work largely under the impulse of projected thought? Is it perhaps to be directed by an energy greater than any of these, but hitherto apparently impotent, the energy of the soul as an expression of pure being? Is it to be swept into action under the impulse of sentient reactions, ideas, and thoughts emanating from other human beings? Or is it to be motivated and spurred into activity under the direction of the spiritual hierarchy? Such are some of the questions to which answers must be found. The stage of aspiring, dreaming, and of wishful thinking must now be superseded by direct action and by the carefully planned use of the available forces swept into activity by the breath under the direction of the inner eye and controlled by the spiritual man. Which energies can and must be thus used? What forces must be brought under direction? In what manner can they be controlled? Should they be ignored and so rendered futile by that ignoring, or are they forces which are needed in the great creative work? It will be apparent to you that the first step the spiritual investigator has to take is to ascertain, truly and in the light of his soul, where exactly is his focus of identification. By that I mean, is his major use of energy to be found upon the mental plane? Is he predominantly emotional and utilizing force from the astral plane the greater part of the time? Can he contact the soul and bring in soul energy in such a manner that it negates or offsets his personality force? Can he thus live like a soul upon the physical plane via the etheric body? If he earnestly studies this problem, he will in time discover which forces are dominant in the etheric body, and will become aware consciously of the times and experience which call for the expenditure of soul energy. This, my brother, will take time, and will be the result of prolonged observation and a close analysis of acts and sentient reactions, of words and thoughts. We are here concerned, as you can see, with an intensely practical problem, which is at the same time an intrinsic part of our study, and which will be evocative of basic changes in the life of the disciple. He will add to this observation and analysis of the strength of the force or the forces engaged, the conditions which will swing them into action, the frequency of their appearance, indicating to him novelty or habit, and likewise the nature of their expression. In this way he will arrive at a new understanding of the conditioning factors which work through his vital body and make him, upon the physical plane, what he essentially is. This will prove to him of deep spiritual and significant help. This period of observation is, however, confined to mental and intelligent observation. It forms the background of the work to be done, giving assurance and knowledge, but leaving the situation as it was. His next step is to become aware of the quality of the forces applied. In ascertaining this, he will find it necessary to discover not only his soul ray and his personality ray, but to know also the rays of his mental apparatus and his emotional nature. This will lead necessarily to another period of investigation and careful observation if he is not already aware of them. When I tell you that to this information he must add a close consideration of the potencies of the forces and energies reaching him astrologically, you will see what a stern task he has set himself. Not only has he to isolate his five ray energies, but he has to allow for the energy of his sun sign as it conditions his personality, and of his rising sign as it seeks to stimulate that personality into soul responsiveness, thus working out soul purpose through personality cooperation. There are, therefore, seven factors which condition the quality of the forces which seek expression through the etheric body. 1. The ray of the soul. 2. The ray of the personality. 3. The ray of the mind. 4. The ray of the emotional nature. 5. The ray of the physical vehicle. 6. The energy of the sun sign. 7. The influence of the rising sign. Once, however, these are ascertained and there is some assurance as to their factual truth, the entire problem begins to clarify and the disciple can work with knowledge and understanding. He becomes a scientific worker in the field of hidden forces. He knows then what he is doing, with what energies he must work, and he begins to feel these energies as they find their way into the etheric vehicle. Now comes the stage wherein he is in a position to find out the reality and the work of the seven centers which provide inlet and outlet for the moving forces and energies with which he is immediately concerned in this particular incarnation. He enters upon a prolonged period of observation, of experiment and experience, and institutes a trial and error, a success and failure campaign, which will call for all the strength, courage, and endurance of which he is capable. Broadly speaking, the energy of the soul works through the highest head center and is brought into activity through meditation and applied aptitude in contact. The energy of the integrated personality is focused through the ajna center, between the eyes. And when the disciple can identify himself with that and is also aware of the nature and the vibration of his soul energy, then he can begin to work with the power of direction, using the eyes as directing agencies. There are, as you have gathered in your studies, three eyes of vision and direction at the disposal of the disciple. 1. The inner eye, the single eye of the spiritual man. This is the true eye of vision and involves the idea of duality, of the seer and that which is seen. It is the divine eye. It is that through which the soul looks forth into the world of men, and through which direction of the personality takes place. 2. The right eye, the eye of buddhi, the eye which is in direct responsive relation to the inner eye. Through this eye, the highest activity of the personality can be directed upon the physical plane. You have, therefore, in this connection, a triangle of spiritual forces which can be swept into unique activity by the advanced disciple and initiate. A. The spiritual eye. B. The ajna center. C. The right eye. It is through this triplicity, for instance, that the trained initiate works when dealing with a group of people or with an individual. 3. The left eye, the eye of manas, the distributor of mental energy under correct control, correct as far as personality purposes are concerned. This eye is also a part of a triangle of forces available for the use of the aspirant and the probationary disciple. A. Ajna center. B. Left eye. C. Right eye. The inner or divine eye is quiescent and relatively inactive, being only the organ of observation where the soul is concerned, and it is not yet, in the majority of cases, a distributor of directing soul energy. The disciplined, reoriented aspirant, however, integrated and focused in his purified personality, is using both buddhic and manasic force. He is beginning to be intuitional and predominantly mental. It is when these two triangles are under control and are beginning to function properly that the seven centers in the etheric body are brought under clear direction, become the recipients of the established rhythm of the developed human being, and present consequently an instrument to the soul through which appropriate energies can flow and the full organization and purpose of a functioning Son of God can be manifested on earth. Next comes what we have called the stage of direction, The soul, or the integrated personality, is in command, or, on a higher turn of the spiral, the monad is in command, and the personality is simply then the agent of spirit. Through the two triangles, or through both of them, working synchronously, the centers of the spine, five in all, are brought under rhythmic control. Energy is directed into them or through them. They are steadily brought into a beauty of organization which has been described as a life aflame with God. It is a life of spiritual application and service, wherein the higher triangle is the most potent. The following three statements sum up the story of the eventual release of the disciple from the great illusion. First, as the soul, working through the higher triangle, becomes the directing agent, illusion is dispelled. The mind becomes illumined. Second, as the personality, under the growing influence of the soul, works through the second triangle, glamour is dissipated. The control of the astral nature is broken. Third, as the disciple, working as the soul and as an integrated personality, assumes direction of his life expression, Maya, or the world of etheric energies, becomes devitalized, and only those forces and energies are employed which serve the need of the disciple or the initiate as he fulfills divine intent. You will note that this is all embodied and brought about in the sevenfold work described above. This can be summarized as follows. 1. The disciple discovers the focus of his identification. 2. He ascertains the nature of the forces he is in the habit of using and which perpetually seem to swing him into action. 3. He becomes aware of the strength and frequency of this force expression. All this is carried forward as the mental observer. 4. He becomes conscious of the quality of the forces employed, their ray relation or their astrological significance. This is a sentient feeling activity and is not so basically mental as the previous three stages. 5. He identifies the centers in the etheric body and becomes aware of their individual existence as force agents. 6. The two triangles of vision and direction in the head reach a stage of organization and become A. active and functioning mechanisms. B. related and functioning as one expressive instrument. This is an objective and subjective activity. 7. The galvanizing of the physical body into activity through the medium of the directing agencies in the head and through the centers up the spine. The question now arises as to how this is to be brought about. This brings us to our second point. B. The use of the science of the breath. There has been a great deal of nonsense talked and taught about the science of the breath. Many groups give a great deal of dangerous instruction anent breathing. Dangerous because it is based on book knowledge and its exponents have never practiced it extensively themselves, and dangerous because many groups simply exploit the unready, usually for commercial gain. Fortunately for the mass of aspirants, the information and the instruction given are both feeble, inaccurate, and frequently innocuous, though there are many cases of significantly bad reaction. Fortunately also, the purpose of the average aspirant is so weak that he is incapable of persistent, daily, unchanging compliance with the requirements and fails to render that application which would be the guarantee of a dubious success. Hence, in these cases, no danger exists. Many occult groups exploit the subject in order to build up mystery and to hold out inducements to the unwary, or give their adherents something to do and thus gain kudos for themselves as learned and well-trained occultists. Anyone can teach breathing exercises. It is largely a matter of periodic in-breathing and exhalation, timed and spaced according to the wish of the teacher. Where there is persistence in effort, results will be achieved, and these will usually be undesirable because the average teacher emphasizes the technique of the breath and not the ideas which, upon the energy which that breath engenders, should take form in the life of the disciple.
End of side one of cassette number 6 of Glamour, A World Problem, page 254, continued on side two. Side 2 of cassette number 6 of Glamour, A World Problem, continuing on page 254.
The entire science of the breath is built around the use of the sacred word, the Om. The use of the word is intended to be confined to those aspirants who are earnestly pledged to tread the way, but it has been passed on and its use enjoined by many unscrupulous teachers, particularly those swamis who come from India, pose as holy men, and get the silly women of the Occident into their clutches. The word is then used with no spiritual intent, but simply as a sound which, carried on the breath, produces psychic results which indicate to the gullible their deep spirituality. The trouble is that breathing is inevitably related to the Om, but the effects are dependent upon motive and inner fixed intention. The Oriental, unless he has attained the fourth or fifth initiation, has no true understanding of the Occidental or of his mechanism and equipment, which, as the result of a civilization and a mode of living, differs widely from that of the Oriental. In the East, the problem of the teacher or guru is to take negatively polarized people and make them positive. In the West, the races are, as a whole, positive in attitude and need no such training as is rightly given to the Oriental. What exactly do I mean when I make this statement? I mean that in the East, the will factor, the quality of the first aspect, is absent. The Oriental, particularly the inhabitant of India, lacks will, dynamic incentive, and the ability to exert that inner pressure upon himself which will produce definite results. That is why that particular civilization is so unadaptable to modern civilization. And that is why the people of India make so little progress along the lines of regulated municipal and national life, and why they are so behind the times as far as modern civilized living is concerned. Generalizing, the Occidental is positive and needs the directive force of the soul and can produce it with very little teaching. In the Aryan race, a fusion is today taking place between the will aspect, the mind, and the brain. This is not so in the Orient. It will be so later. The only factor which makes the breath effective is the thought, the intent, and the purpose which lie behind it. In this statement, you have the clue to dynamic, useful breathing exercises. Unless there is a clear appreciation of purpose, unless the disciple knows just what he is doing as he practices esoteric breathing, and unless the significance of the words energy follows thought is understood, breathing exercises are sheer waste of time and can be dangerous. From this, it can be gathered that only when there is an alliance between breathing and thinking will results be possible. Behind this lies a third and even more important factor, the will. Therefore, the only person who can safely and usefully practice breathing exercises is the man whose will is active, his spiritual will, and therefore the will of the spiritual triad. Any disciple who is in process of building the Antahkarana can begin to use, with care, directed breathing exercises. But in the last analysis, it is only the initiates of the third degree and who are coming under monadic influence who can properly and successfully employ this form of life direction and reach effective results. This is fundamentally true. However, a beginning has to be made, and to this effort all true disciples are invited. If all the implications in the above paragraph are considered, it will be apparent that the disciple has to establish, as a preliminary step, a direct relation between his brain, his mind, and the will aspect of the spiritual triad. In other words, the negative receptor of thought, the brain, the agent of the will, the mind, and the triad itself have to be brought into contact with each other via the Antahkarana. When such a relation exists or is beginning to be established, then breathing exercises can safely and profitably be attempted. You see, my brother, only the directed will, using the organized rhythmic breath as its agent, can control the centers and produce an ordered purpose in life. Therefore, it is the dominating idea or line of mental activity with which the disciple must be concerned as he performs a breathing exercise. This idea must embody some purpose, some planned activity, and some recognized goal before the breath, which will engineer or implement it, is generated, assembled, sent forth, and thus becomes the carrier of power. This has to be done upon the wings of conscious intention, if I may here speak symbolically. I would urge you to read these last sentences with frequency because they concern the science of the breath and hold the clue to needed work. This science is primarily and fundamentally concerned with ideas as formulated into clear thought forms, and thus condition the life of the disciple upon etheric levels. From there, they eventually condition his physical plane life. I have no intention here of giving any breathing exercises which disciples or aspirants could use, or, more probably, misuse. Their first responsibility is to become aware of the impulses within themselves, which could galvanize the center's interactivity and so produce conditions and events upon the physical plane. When these are clear and firmly established in the mind consciousness of the disciple, nothing can then stop their emergence in due time into the light of day. But they must follow an ordered process of gestation and of timed appearance. When there is true idealism, right thought, plus an understanding of the vehicle of expression and the world of forces into which the idea has to be launched, then the student can safely follow certain scheduled breathing exercises, and the second phase, or the result of sound rhythmic breathing, will appear. This is inspiration. Breathing exercises, my brother, have a purely physiological effect when not impelled or motivated by directed thought, and when they are not the result of the aspirant attaining and adhering to a point of tension. Steadily, whilst the process of inhalation and exhalation is being carried forward, a clear line of active thinking must be preserved so that the breath, as it is sent out, is qualified and conditioned by some idea. It is here that the average aspirant fails so often. He is usually so intensely preoccupied with the process of directing breathing and so expectant of some phenomenal results that the living purpose of the breath is forgotten. This is to energize and add quality to the life of the centers through the medium of some projected and presented thought, expressing some sensed and determined idea. Where this background of idealistic thought is lacking, then the results of the breath will be practically nil, or, where there are results of any kind under these circumstances, they will be in no way concerned with thought, but will be psychic in nature. They can then produce lasting psychic trouble, for the emanating source of the activity is astral, and the projected energy goes to centers below the diaphragm, thus feeding the lower nature, enriching and strengthening its astral content, and thereby enhancing and deepening glamour. The results can also be physiological, producing the stimulation of the etheric body, leading to the strengthening of the physical nature. This often leads to serious results, for the breath is carried to centers which should be in process of elevation, as it is esoterically called. This increases their physical potency, feeds the physical appetites, and makes the task of the aspirant much harder as he seeks to sublimate the lower nature and anchor or focus the life of the centers above the diaphragm or in the head. Glamour and Maya are then increased, and for the life in which these exercises are misapplied, the aspirant remains in a static and unprofitable condition. As he breathes in or inhales, he draws the breath from within his own aura, his auric ring pass knot. He feeds the lower nature and sets up a vicious circle within himself which strengthens day by day until he is completely enmeshed by the glamour and Maya which he is constantly establishing and re-establishing. The lower centers are steadily vitalized and become extremely active, and the point of tension from which the aspirant then works is found in the personality and is not focused in relation to the soul. The consciousness of the uniqueness of special breathing and the expectancy of phenomenal results bar out all thought, except lower reactions of a karma manasic nature. Emotion is fostered, and the power of the astral body is tremendously increased. Very frequently also the physiological results are potent and noticeable, such as a great chest development and the muscular strengthening of the diaphragm. Something of this can be seen in the case of operatic singers. Singing, as now taught, is an expression of some of the lower aspects of the breath, and the breathing in the case of the above vocalists produces much breast development, intensifying emotionalism, producing instability in the life expression, which is often referred to as temperament, and keeps the singing aspect entirely astral in nature. There is a higher and better mode of song, actuated by a difference in the point of tension and involving a breathing process which draws the needed energy upon the breath from sources higher and far more extensive than those normally used. This will produce the inspiration which will involve the whole man and not simply his emotional reaction to the theme of his song and his audience. This will bring into being a new mode and type of singing and of breathing, based on a form of mental breathing which will carry energy and consequent inspiration from sources without the personality aura. The time for this is not yet. My words will be little understood today, but the singing in the next century will be by those who will know how to tap the reservoirs of inspiration by means of a new method and technique in breathing. These techniques and exercises will be taught, to start with, in the new and coming schools of esotericism. Inspiration is a process of qualifying, vitalizing, and stimulating the reaction of the personality, via the centers, to that point of tension where soul control becomes present and apparent. It is the mode whereby energy from the soul can flood the personality life, can sweep through the centers, expelling that which hinders, ridding the aspirant of all remaining glamours and maya, and perfecting an instrument whereby the music of the soul, and later the musical quality of the hierarchy, can be heard. Forget not that sound permeates all forms. The planet itself has its own note or sound. Each minute atom also has its sound. Each form can be evoked into music, and each human being has his peculiar chord, and all chords contribute to the great symphony which the hierarchy and humanity are playing, and playing now. Every spiritual group has its own tune, if I may employ so inappropriate a word, and the groups which are in process of collaborating with the hierarchy make music ceaselessly. This rhythm of sound and this myriad of chords and notes blend with the music of the hierarchy itself, and this is a steadily enriching symphony. As the centuries slip away, all these sounds slowly unite and are resolved into each other until someday the planetary symphony which Sanat Kumara is composing will be completed, and our Earth will then make a notable contribution to the great chords of the solar system. And this is a part, intrinsic and real, of the music of the spheres. Then, as the Bible says, the sons of God, the planetary Logoi, will sing together. This, my brother, will be the result of right breathing, of controlled and organized rhythm, of true pure thought, and of the correct relation between all parts of the chorus. Think out this theme as a meditation exercise and gain inspiration thereby. C. The technique of indifference. I have in my other books given much information anent the etheric body and the centers, major and minor, which are to be found within its radius. There is a tendency among students to identify the centers with the physical body in their thinking, and not so clearly with the etheric body. This concerns location in the majority of cases, and is a mistake. Aspirants would do well to avoid any concentration at all upon the physical body, and learn gradually to shift their focus of attention into the etheric body. Necessarily, the physical body is active and potent, but increasingly it should be regarded as an automaton, influenced and directed by 1. The vital body and the forces of Maya, or by inspiration, emanating from points of spiritual tension. 2. The astral vehicle and the forces of glamour, or sentient conscious love, emanating from the soul. 3. The mind and the forces of illusion, or by illumination, coming from higher sources than the life in the three worlds. 4. The soul as the vehicle of monadic impression, until such time as the antarkarana is built, that bridge in mental matter, which will eventually link the monad and the personality. One of the problems which disciples have to solve is the source of the incentive, impulses, impressions, or inspiration which, via the etheric body, sweep the physical vehicle into activity upon the physical plane, thus giving a demonstration of the quality, purpose, and point of tension of the incarnating man, and manifesting the nature of the man as he is at any particular point upon the ladder of evolution. According to the tensions and impulses indicated will be the activity of the centers. You can see, therefore, how much that I teach reverses the usual occult procedures. I teach no mode of awakening the centers, because right impulse, steady reaction to higher impulsions, and the practical recognition of the sources of inspiration will automatically and safely swing the centers into needed and appropriate activity. This is the sound method of development. It is slower, but it leads to no premature development and produces a rounded-out unfoldment. It enables the aspirant to become truly the observer and to know with surety what he is doing. It brings the centers, one by one, to a point of spiritual responsiveness and then establishes the ordered and cyclic rhythm of a controlled lower nature. That breathing exercises may eventually find a place in the training of the disciple is true and possible, but they will be self-initiated as a result of rhythmic living and a constant right use of the sacred word, the Om. When, for instance, a disciple in meditation sounds the Om 7 times, it is the equivalent of a breathing exercise. When he can send the energy thus generated on the wings of conscious planned thought to one or other of the centers, he is bringing about changes and readjustments within the mechanism which handles force, and when this can be carried out with ease and with the mind held at a point of thoughtful tension, then the disciple is well on the way to shifting his entire focus of attention away from the world of illusion, glamour, and Maya, and into the realm of the soul, in the world of the clear, cold light, and into the kingdom of God. When he also adds to this an understanding and a practice of the technique of indifference, he stands free and liberated, and is essentially at all times the observer and user of the apparatus of manifestation. What is this technique? What is indifference? I wonder, brother of mine, if you understand the significance of this word, indifference. It means, in reality, the achieving of a neutral attitude towards that which is regarded as the not-self. It involves a repudiation of similarity. It marks the recognition of a basic distinction. It signifies refusal to be identified with anything save the spiritual reality, as far as that is sensed and known, at any given point in time and space. It is, therefore, a much stronger and vital thing than what is usually meant when the word is used. It is active repudiation without any concentration upon that which is repudiated. That is a statement of moment and warrants your careful consideration. It is concerned with the point of tension from which the observing disciple or aspirant is working. The point of tension becomes the emanating source of some type of energy, and this pours down into and through the etheric body without being in any way affected by Maya or by the concentration of diverse forces of which the etheric body is ever composed. Indifference, technically understood, signifies direct descent from there to here without deviation or distortion. The manifesting entity, the disciple, stands steady and firm at this point of tension, and his first step is, therefore, to ascertain where that is, on what plane it is found, and what is the strength of the tension upon which he has to depend. The next step is to discover if that which he seeks to convey to the physical body, and thus produce effects upon the outer world of experiment and experience, is distorted by illusion of any kind, arrested in its expression by glamour, or liable to be sidetracked by uncontrolled forces and by the Maya which these produce. This he ascertains not by identifying himself, stage by stage of descent, with the hindrances and possible obstructions, but by intensifying his point of tension, by the constant recollection of the truth that he is the self and not the not-self, and by a process of projection. This projection is defined as sending of energy, qualified and recognized, from the point of tension direct and undeviatingly to the vital body, from whence it can find its way to the 7 centers of control. It is at this point that he applies the technique of indifference, For, if he does not, that which he is seeking to express may be held up and arrested by etheric force or by the veils of Maya. He works, consequently, from a point of intense concentration. He refuses any attachment to any form or plane as he projects the energy into and through the three worlds. When he discovers any arresting or sidetracking of progress through active illusion or glamour, he detaches himself consciously from such contacts and braces himself for the final stage of indifference or repudiation of all forces except those which he, consciously and with purpose, is seeking to use upon the physical plane. In the last analysis, my brother, the point of tension for the average disciple will be found on mental levels involving the illumined mind and a growing soul contact. A. He will be able then to see clearly in the light of the soul and with a developed sense of values. He can consequently dispel illusion. B. He will be able to project light consciously onto the astral plane and can thus dissipate glamour. C. He will be able to pour light energy through the etheric body and anchor the light or energy in the appropriate centers because there will be complete indifference or non-identification with Maya. Where the initiate is concerned, the process is carried on at first from a point of tension within the soul and later from a point of tension in the spiritual triad. In all cases, however, once within the ring-pass knot of the three worlds, the directing energy produces results as outlined in this book and brings about 1. The dispelling of illusion, 2. The dissipation of glamour, 3. The overcoming of Maya. It sounds fairly simple and easy of accomplishment as the aspirant reads these fairly simple elucidations of a difficult process, but that in itself is delusion. Age-long identification with the form side of life is not easily overcome, and the task ahead of the disciple is a long and arduous one, but one which promises eventual success, provided there is clear thinking, earnest purpose, and planned scientific work. Section 4, The Technique of Fusion. In this, our final point, we are concerned with the control, constant and unremitting, of the soul over the personality. We are therefore concerned with the stage of initiation which brings to an end the path of development for humanity and inaugurates a cycle of existence of which we know and can know nothing except that the liberated master then begins to function in a dual manner, as a member of the hierarchy cooperating with the plan and occupied with the salvaging of humanity, and secondly, as a disciple of Sanat Kumara. The task of Sanat Kumara in relation to the masters is to prepare them to tread the way of the higher evolution. When this becomes possible, the shift of the spiritual attention, I use this inadequate word for lack of a better one, is away from the soul and the angel of the presence, to the mysterious presence itself. This has hitherto only been sensed and dimly visioned. The master, freed from the three and five worlds of human and so-called superhuman evolution, has now the full gifts of omnipresence and omniscience. He is aware of the underlying unity brought about by the factual nature of the one life and being who pervades all manifestation. He has also mastered all possible techniques and modes and methods of activity, of control, and of fusion. But having developed those capacities, he now becomes faintly aware of that which conditions the one being and senses energies and contacts which are extraplanetary and of which he has hitherto been totally unaware. Knowledge comes to him after the fifth initiation. Before him lies the attainment of a still higher range of perceptions, and in order to garner the reward of those possible contacts, he has to master techniques and methods of development which will make him omnipotent and therefore expressive of the highest of the three divine aspects. This development will put into his grasp potencies and experiences which can only be manipulated and understood through the scientific activity of the will, and this must be implemented from a point of tension, focused in whatever is meant by the word monad. Do you know what that means, my brother? I am sure that you do not, Only the masters of the wisdom have any appreciation of these final unfoldments, and then only in the sense of the will-full aspiration, a phase of aspiration which is characterized by the conscious will, just as the aspiration of the disciple is characterized by sublimated desire. These things are, however, beyond the comprehension of the average disciple. Their sole value is to depict the unending opportunity which presents itself at every stage and point of crisis upon the everlasting way. We are concerned at this time with the great point of crisis which faces the disciple when he attempts to resolve the final pair of opposites prior to certain major initiations. This is the confronting the personality by the angel of the presence. There is no need for me to define the two aspects of the disciple's nature, for that is what they essentially are. You have been told and have known that the dweller upon the threshold is the fully developed personality, the sum total of all the past and the composite presentation upon the physical plane of all unresolved problems, all undeclared desires, all latent characteristics and qualities, all phases of thought and of self-will, all lower potencies and ancient habits of any of the three bodies, both bad and good. These, in their totality, are brought to the surface of consciousness, there to be dealt with in such a way that their control is broken. The disciple is then free to take the final initiations. This process is not consummated in one particular facing of the two antagonistic forces. It is a threefold process covering each of the three periods before the first three initiations, or, from the angle of the hierarchy, before the two initiations of the threshold and the first major initiation, the transfiguration. For many lives, the disciple has been dwelling upon the threshold. He himself is the dweller. Behind the slowly opening door, he senses life, energy, spiritual embodiment, and the fact of the angel. Between him and that door is a burning ground. This he faces, and this he knows he has to cross if he seeks to pass through the door. The question for him to answer is whether his will to achieve is strong enough for him to submit his personal lower self to the fires of the final purification. The personal self is now very highly developed. It is a useful instrument which the soul can use. It is a highly trained agent for service. It is essentially a piece of adequate and useful equipment. It has, however, its points of weakness, which are liable at any time to present points of crisis. It has likewise its points of strength, which can be transmuted with relative ease into points of tension. On the whole, it is a dependable instrument and one which can render good service. Can it and should it be sacrificed so that, esoterically speaking, its life is lost and in its place consecration and devotion are substituted? This is a hard problem for all disciples to solve, to understand, and to make effectively practical. Only by crossing the burning ground three successive times are all impediments to the free use of the will destroyed. The relation between the angel and the dweller must be released by means of the will to full expression. I here refer to the spiritual will and to its three aspects which must be brought into play before the divine will can begin to control. The disciple brings the two aspects of his nature together in full consciousness and with clear intention through a planned act of the will, and this act produces a point of tension in the center of the burning ground wherein the two can meet, as the ancient archives put it. I would call your attention to the fact that it is at a midway point that the great submission of the lower to the higher takes place. It does not happen when the disciple hovers uncertainly upon the periphery of the burning ground, or when he stands before the door with the burning ground experience behind him. The essential point of crisis, producing the needed point of tension, is the result of the invocative decision of the personality, which in time produces an evocative response from the angel. The two factors involved, and forget not, my brother, that all this takes place within the field of consciousness of the disciple, move together and towards each other. In the center of the burning ground they meet, and then the lesser light, a true light in its own right, of the personality is absorbed into the greater light of the angel or soul. The angel therefore occultly obliterates the dweller, who becomes lost to sight in the radiant aura of the angel. This has been symbolically portrayed for us in the picture book of the heavens, when, according to Catholic festivals, the Assumption of the Virgin takes place and the constellation Virgo is lost to sight in the radiance of the sun. There you have the three factors: one, the Virgin, material form, personality, dweller; two, the sun, spiritual nature, soul, angel; three, the earth, aspiring man, the disciple. The personality remains, it still exists, but it is seen no more as of old. The light of the angel envelops it. The burning ground has done its work, and the personality is now nothing more or less than the purified shell or form through which the light, the radiance, the quality, and the characteristics of the angel can shine. It is a fusion of lights, with the stronger and the more powerful obliterating the lesser. How has this been brought about? I refer not here to the preparation of the dweller on the threshold for this great event, or to the aeon of disciplining, of preparation, of experiment, and of experience from life to life, which has made this consummating event possible and successful. The two aspects in man can only meet in full power and with intention and finality when illusion can no longer control the mind, when glamour has lost all power to veil, and when the forces of Maya can no longer hinder. Discrimination, dispassion, and indifference have produced the dispelling through focused light, the dissipating potency of distributed light, and the directing power of light energy. Only five recognitions now control the disciple: 1, the fact of his discipleship; 2, the perception of the angel, waiting and dynamic; 3, the invocative appeal of the dweller on the threshold; 4, the necessity to use the will in a new and different manner; 5, the need to cross the burning ground. The issues are now entirely clear. It is a question of timing and of decision. I would remind you that in all these processes, it is the disciple who, in full consciousness, acts. He initiates all the processes himself. It is not the angel or the dweller, but the spiritual man himself who has to employ the will and take definite forward moving action. Once the disciple has taken the necessary steps and moved irrevocably forward, the response of the angel is sure, automatic, and all-enveloping. Complete obliteration of the personal self in three successive stages is the immediate and normal result. It was to this that John the Baptist referred when he said, "He shall increase, but I must decrease." When he spoke these words, he spoke as a disciple prior to the second initiation of the threshold. This occult waxing and waning is portrayed for us in the phases of the moon, and for the planet as a whole, in the sign Gemini, where the light of one of the twins is slowly dimming and the light of the other is gaining in intensity. When this occult obliteration has taken place, what then is the destiny of the disciple? It is complete control by the soul, and this in practice connotes group realization, group work, group service, and eventually group initiation. With these developments, it is not my intent to deal, for I have covered much of these matters in my other books. Here I have been dealing in this short elucidation with the effects that substances and the substantial forces found in the three worlds produce in the disciple and as they affect the aspirant. I have not considered the problem of glamour, illusion, and Maya from the angle of average man. The latter is necessarily immersed in them, and under their constant impact he passes his life. By their means he learns. He is not at the point where he seeks deliverance from them, as does the man upon the path. I have therefore considered the problem from the angle of the disciples and aspirants. From them the way opens up, and for them comes the conscious recognition of the light. The need for the service of men and women, free from illusion and glamour, has never been so dramatically present as it is today, and it is for these potential servers of a desperate necessity that I have written. That the angel of the presence may make his nearness felt and inspire you to pass courageously through the fires of the burning ground is my earnest prayer. That the fact of the presence may be sensed by you and lead you to greater activity once the burning ground is passed is my deepest wish for you. and that the light may shine upon your way and bring a certain and assured consummation of all the travail and struggle which has characterized your way of life, is my heart's desire for you. To more active and steady enterprise I call you. The Tibetan. End of Glamour, A World Problem by Alice A. Bailey. Copyright 1950 by Lucis Trust. Books by Alice A. Bailey. Initiation, Human and Solar. Letters on Occult Meditation. The Consciousness of the Atom. A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. The Light of the Soul. The Soul and Its Mechanism. From Intellect to Intuition. A Treatise on White Magic. From Bethlehem to Calvary. Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 1. Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2. Problems of Humanity. The Reappearance of the Christ. The Destiny of the Nations. Glamour, A World Problem. Telepathy and the Etheric Vehicle. The Unfinished Autobiography. Education in the New Age. The Externalization of the Hierarchy. A Treatise on the Seven Rays, Volume 1, Esoteric Psychology. Volume 2, Esoteric Psychology. Volume 3, Esoteric Astrology. Volume 4, Esoteric Healing. Volume 5, Rays and Initiations. This recording is made available by Lucis Trust, 866 United Nations Plaza, Suite 566, New York, New York, 10017.